Agricultured, 5 Oxfordshire Farmers. I visited 5 Oxfordshire farms in early summer 2002. I wanted to find out from farmers what changes they had witnessed in agriculture over their working lives. Economists would see increasing capitalisation in the agricultural industry as machinery has replaced labour. They would also note the emergence of international markets and consolidation in the food and agricultural sector. The conversations you'll hear in this programme reveal these changes and show what it means to these individuals who live and work as farmers. Clive Hawes farms sheep and cereals at Grange Farm near Bicester. He diversified a number of years ago. Beside farming, he also trades in timber and develops property, including setting up a nursing home, which he runs with his wife. I spoke with him over his kitchen table. Clive Hawes.
I'm 48 years old, been farming here all my life. My father was a farmer and my grandfather before me. Probably 5 or 6 generations, as far back as family knowledge goes.
So could you go back to when you started working here? You're working with your father on the farm?
Yeah, lots and lots of labour.
That's about 48 years ago.
Well, I was born 48 years ago, I suppose. I started going down the farm. I was always taken down the farm as a baby because my mum and dad were milking down there. So I can remember from about 3 years on, and they were milking in a very old fashioned parlour, very unmechanised, whereas today it's totally changed around the other way.
Was it a small herd?
It would be considered a very small herd today, but in those days they considered it to be quite large. I think they started with about 50 cows and built up over 10 years to about 200, which in those days was considered large. Today, of course, 1,000 is large and 500 is probably a fair-sized herd.
When you started going to Arable, did the farm get larger? Did you take on more land?
You've been
in farming about 30 years, roughly. Is that about right? Or here at this farm with your father?
Well, my father died when I was, I think, about 18, so I've been doing it on my own for 30 years. Once we went into Arable, we did take over a lot more land. As farms became available and guys retired, we would take over the farm and sort of contract farm it or share farm it with them. And we would have ended up, I suppose, or I would have ended up in about, 15, 20 years ago, I would have had about 1,000 acres all under Arable.
That's quite a size.
But nowadays, of course, it's not. I mean, now you're looking at guys in the area that are probably doing 5,000 acres. And they'll be the people that continue, and I guess in 10 years' time they'll probably have 20,000 acres because it will go in multiples. You know, the machinery is that much bigger. I remember fields that I used to bale. I used to do the balings because we needed a lot of straw back here for the livestock. And there's a farm between here and Bicester, which was 400 acres of arable, and it would take me about a month to bale that. Now, with the big high-density balers, like last year, I saw the guys go in, they'd baled and cleared the whole farm in 3 days, and it was one man. Whereas when we were doing it, we'd have, like, me baling, 3 guys pitching and loading the bales, and another couple snacking them back in the barn, you know, so 5 men working for 30 days, you've got 150 men days replaced by 3 days. It's just incredible. I mean, it's a fundamental difference.
When you started going to Arable, did you... was that all subcontracted, or did you use were the employees who lived on the farm, were they started going into that? Or?
No, we always used contractors because we could see from our point of view it was far cheaper to go the contract route than it was to have our own machinery.
And then, of course, there's the associations, producer association. I don't know if you're a member of any producer associations.
No, I'm not. I've always tried to, for whatever reason, I sort of paddle my own canoe, to be honest. I've kept away from that. But, of course, the biggest... media, the biggest way to learn what was going on was the markets, the livestock markets, because then you would meet everybody else, you'd all pick to pick up here and there. If there was a new subsidy or a new rule coming out, it would be discussed in the bar, and everybody that went was switched on. And of course, that's gone.
Presumably, farmers go to the market. Did the frequency in which they went to the market, did that change over of your farming livelihood?
Well, definitely, yeah, because the market's gradually shut down. I used to be in the markets at one stage. I would have been in the markets 5 days a week, because I said I also sort of digressed into the meat trade, so I was purchasing livestock as well as selling livestock. So I would have done a different market 5 days a week. And from that, obviously, I was meeting different people from different areas. Well, of those markets I used to cover, there's probably only Tame that's still going. And Tame's going purely by chance because a group of farmers got together and bought it as a co-op. And I think if any survive, they probably will.
What were the, can you remember the names of the other markets you used to go to?
Yeah, I would do Bicester Market on a Monday, Stratford Market on a Tuesday, Aylesbury Market on a Wednesday, Banbury Market on a Thursday, and Friday, I think Andoversford probably was a Friday, but Friday was like a bit of an iffy day. Could sometimes be Chippenham. I don't know if Chippenham's still going up.
I think Banbury used to be one of the largest...
Banbury was the largest livestock market in Europe. And
were you surprised when that closed?
I could probably see it coming. With hindsight, it closed because the business wasn't there to be done. There weren't the buyers, and without the buyers, there's no point in having the market. I mean, I've been in Banbury Market when there'd be 2,000 fat cattle, 10,000 sheep, a couple of thousand pigs, and, you know, 500 barren cows, not to mention a few bits and other pieces that were there, on one day. And there'd be like hundreds of people there, all trading, which made a very healthy, in my opinion, it made a very healthy community. That's what I used to enjoy. That's, to me, what it was about, you know, mixing, interacting. To me, being stuck in one place, just looking after my sheep and that romantic thing is not what I want.
So what's replaced those markets?
I think, obviously, direct selling has now replaced them because the foot and mouth issue really forced what was happening anyway, probably forced it on ahead by 2 or 3 years. So people had no option but to sell their livestock to the abattoirs during the foot and mouth thing. Producer groups, which is a good thing, and various cooperatives that are selling direct to the abattoirs anyway.
That was Clive Hawes. Jane Bowler and her husband raise pigs at Meadow Farm near East Hanney. She sells the pigs as pork, direct to the public, through her farm shop and at the local farmers' markets. Her son is the butcher at the farm shop, and I visited Jane at her farm, which is beside the busy main road between Oxford and Wantage. Jane Bowler.
I describe myself as a farmer.
Do you say you're a pig farmer or a livestock farmer? Or?
A pig farmer, yeah.
Yeah, with your father's main business, farming?
It was originally, yes, yeah, until he sold the farm in about 1968.
How old were you when he sold the farm?
About 17, so 18.
You'd grown up on a farm, hadn't
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah. It was milking. We were dairy milking.
Did you take any part
in Yeah, that? I left school to milk the cows.
At what age did you leave school?
15. And I loved it. I mean, I really used to be out there. The dairy was my, you know, pristine. Then it meant spending thousands of pounds on a new dairy parlour, and we were only a small farm. And my brother couldn't do the farming for medical reasons, so Dad sort of thought, oh, well, you know, Jane will be off and married, you know. Daughters, it does tend to be a bit like that, you know.
Was it a family farm? Did your father employ anyone to work with him on the farm?
Well, that was part of it, really. If you're a family farm and you're small, unless you've got somebody working, you're working 7 days a week, 52 weeks of the year. So it was either get bigger so that you could employ people or carry on, you know, sort of struggling on. And you really then, you had to have a house. Especially if you were milking, you had to have a house for whoever it was, you know, to work, supply a house, to get a good person to work for you. I don't think farming was in too good of a state in 67 it was. 67,
well,
yeah.
What sort of size was the farm then?
It was about 150 acres. And it was just at that point where everybody was getting quite a lot bigger, most people were. And I think the dairy prices were difficult, you know, even then. I know there was, you know, the milk marketing board and all that then, of course, but the other thing was, of course, the milk churning. We were on milk churns then, and everybody, so it was new practices, new machinery, really, because the everybody was going into bulk tanks. So this was the whole scenario, was you had to change your system, really.
And you think your father didn't want to do that?
No. I think he just thought it was an awful lot of money to invest. You know, probably borrowed to invest at that amount of money at that time.
Now, what did he do when he left farming and he sold the farm?
Well, he'd already got a coal business anyway, and
he was a coal merchant.
Yes,
was he
was a coal merchant as well, and he used to do light haulage as well, because he'd got the coal lorry. So there, it worked quite well, because when the farm was busy in the summer, nobody wanted any coal, and in the winter, when the coal was busy, the farm, you know, it's a fairly quiet time on the farm.
That was Jane Bowler. David Orpwood is leaving farming to work as a consultant. Foot and mouth, he says, was the final straw. He produces pigs at Woods Farm near Watlington, which are sold for fattening. I spoke with him in his farm office, and in the background you can hear newly hatched chickens.
Well, I'm a farmer, full-time professional farmer. Who's just exiting the industry. I've had a pigs and sheep due to the total collapse in the industry, or the commodity price of the industry. I couldn't continue any longer without losing everything I've got. I sincerely hope I won't lose my house, although I'm prepared, well, not prepared, I'm aware in the meek and misty background that I might lose it because of the amount of debt built up. When I went into it, I started with 200 sows.
What sort of date do you think that would be, roughly?
Well, when I started?
Yeah.
5th of November 1979.
Gosh, you can remember that very clearly.
Well, yeah. It's a big step in my life, wasn't it, really? You know, starting up my own farming enterprise. 5th of November is not difficult to remember, is it? Because it's fireworks day.
Is that because you had to sign a contract? Or
No.
That's...
It was the farm sale, and I bought 200 sows at the farm sale. And the farm sale was the guy I used to work for, Roland Harris, he was getting out of pigs. So I bought 200 sows out of his business. I think I bought 98 sows in pig and 110 gilts that hadn't been served yet. So I went into it and I just worked bloody hard. I worked 7 days a week like I still do, unfortunately. And I was on my own to start with these 200 sows on someone else's land, which I rented. And it was very exciting. I'm getting out of agriculture at the moment, and I've got 570 pigs left to sell. That's growing pigs. All my sows are now gone. They went by the end of April. We built a herd up to 1,200 sows. And in the beginning of 1998, we sell what's called store pigs, which is a pig at 32 kilos that someone else buys and fattens. We haven't got the facilities or the room to fatten them. And we were selling pigs at £40 a piece, and you know that was good business. And within 6 weeks, they dropped from £40 a piece to £11 a piece, which is equivalent to £2 of bacon. I'd got a year's supply backed up, you know, from when the boar to growing and everything. And so I couldn't stop it, you know. I couldn't just say stop. You know, I haven't got a widget factory which I can just stop today. Anyway, so I was, and that gave me a big loss. I mean, I'd built my business up out of profits, which I thought was the right thing to do, and some of it was borrowed money as well. So I'd built up a strong, viable business with a turnover of £1 million, which in agriculture is quite a lot.
Do you know why the market price dropped so much?
Yeah, it dropped a number of reasons. The pound strengthened against the Deutschmark. The Russians suddenly became bankrupt and they couldn't afford to buy any meat. so that pig meat suffered. And the tiger economy went through depression too, and there were big, big importers of pig meat. So those three things took us apart. And the fourth one, of course, is that the EU had then got quite a lot of pig meat. We were oversupply of pig meat. And we lost all our export markets, so, you know, total supply and demand, because the pig industry has no subsidy.
Was your decision to get out farming mostly due to foot and mouth, or had you made the decision before that?
No, I hadn't made the decision before that. Foot and mouth cost me last year, on my budgeted income, it cost me £75,600 last year. We've seen a lot of imports, of increase in imports of food from the continent in 2001, after Foot and Mouth was announced. The Minister of Agriculture, Nick Brown, who I know well, stopped all livestock movement for a week when we got Foot and Mouth in this country, which I think was the right thing to do. But what it did, it opened floodgates of food coming into this country. And if you look in the first 2 weeks of March, every motorway was absolutely quagmire with food coming, you know, from the continent, being spread all over this country, and it's done horrendous damage to agriculture. And it was the final straw. I just couldn't, I couldn't see myself to break out of what I saw as a spiralling down of my net worth, because I was so heavily involved politically in Foot and Mouth, and because I was so depressed about the whole situation, like many, many farms were, I wasn't astute enough to realise the problem.
That was David Orpwood. Marilyn Iving and her husband farm at Mill Farm near Church Instone, Chipping Norton Way. They grow cereals and keep cattle and poultry. The eggs from their ducks and chickens are sold at the door and through the village shop. I spoke with Marilyn in her sitting room. Marilyn Iving.
I always call myself a farmer, which can put people back on their heels a bit. You know, they think you ought to describe yourself as a farmer's wife or something, but I'm equally as much of a farmer as my husband, so. And he wouldn't call himself a farmer's husband, would he? So I always say, you know, that I'm a farmer. We are a Marks and Spencer's preferred farm. So they came round and had a look, and we had to answer a whole series of questions and such like, and we passed their standards. So our cattle can go as Marks and Spencer's. They go up to Nuneaton to an abattoir there.
And that's one that Marks and Spencer specifies in?
Yes. We were very lucky, really. I think there are probably two in the Chipping Norton area. It's probably, within perhaps 10 miles of Chipping Norton, something like that. So we're very, very lucky that we passed. But it means that you get a slight premium. And, of course, you've got a certain market, you know, which is very good. Because if you sell to an abattoir that doesn't specialise, then they are dependent upon people buying on that particular day. And if they've got a lot of buyers, then the price is up. And if they've only one or two buyers, then they have a lot of what you might call overproduction, and so the price falls. Whereas with sending them to the Marks and Spencer's place, then you know what you're going to get, and it's not going to alter.
You told me about your three children.
Yes.
And they all work off the farm. Do you think any of them will take over from you farming here?
I rather doubt it.
And what do they say about farming?
I think they have a rosy view that they would love to bring their children up on a farm. But they certainly wouldn't want the hours. They wouldn't want the returns. And I don't think they would want the gamble of it, you know, the insecurity, really. They've got as I say, good jobs with good money. And really, they're better off doing what they're doing. There isn't anything very much on the farm that you can do by pressing a button. Most of it involves, I mean, when you're putting machinery on and off tractors and things, it's quite a heavy manual job.
What do you think will happen to the farm when you retire and you stop farming? Because although you say you're retired, you're still doing some farming here.
Yes. Well, when we pop our clogs, I have an idea that the whole lot will be lotted up and sold.
That was Marilyn Iving. Charles Piers lives at Views Farm near Oxford. Although he says he's retired from farming in April last year, he still oversees his farm. The farm grows organic cereals and keeps beef and free-range chickens. He's also developed holiday accommodation and converted farm buildings into offices for rent. I spoke with Charles as he pored over his dining room table. Charles Piers.
I'm a bit of farmer at Views Farm, Great Milton, Oxfordshire, since 1974, but farmed all my life, mainly arable.
So initially you sold your grain to?
An ordinary grain merchant, whoever there was. I mean, there was one in Tame, there was one in Abingdon, and basically speaking I dealt with them, mainly. The one in Abingdon.
Do you remember what they're called?
Yes, I mean, the Abingdon one was Harris and Matthews. Used to be the old jail. That was there. That's where their depot was. I remember going all around the old jail. They had different cells, different lots of corn. And the one in town was Howland and Bush. They were taken over by a firm called Franklin's in Bedford, who was immediately taken over by Dargettys. And, well, it disappeared. And then I thought, well, we'd try a co-op, because that's really the way we should be going, very much in favour of co-op trading. And there was a company, they were taken over by West Midland Farmers down in Gloucester, called Three Rivers or something. And that worked quite well. And then they sort of disbanded. We had a grain group, and then it was sort of disbanded, or I forget what happened, but I went back to this other guy who was trading then with a big company, or a big-ish company, but a big independent company down in Winchester. And then they were taken over by Banks about 7 or 8 years ago, and dealt with Banks Southern. It's the same company, until I packed up, really. But it was getting to the stage where I'm not happy about it. Because basically speaking, with grain, you see, you've got about 3 buyers, that's all. And they're just playing silly buggers with farmers.
What are those 3 buyers?
For grain?
Yeah.
Well, there's Banks, Banks, Grain Farmers, and Cargill.
They're all national companies, aren't they? Cargill's is
obviously. Cargill's international. Mm. Banks and Cargill have joined forces, you see. Yeah. So it's only grain farmers. There was a big co-op called Viking Grain, and they went bust this year. So it's you know, that's some of the trouble. There are 200,000 farmers dealing with, basically speaking, 3 supermarkets, 2 grain merchants, 4 fertiliser companies. Not a chance.
Do you think they have a lot of control?
Well, I'm pretty sure they do. But they got power, real power. And that's where we slipped up in agriculture all along. We would not cooperate. That's why the French farmers are so strong. Because they speak with one voice.